it's a whole different mechanism of injury than if I'm standing up there and fall off the edge. Mechanism of injury, yes, it shows you what happened to the patient, but it also tells you as the examiner how deep you have to look. If I fall from here to the floor, typically kind of superficial, unless I ricochet off that thing a couple times, okay? If I fall from up there, it's deeper. You're looking at other things. If we think back, and I'm going to use this one. If I offend somebody, I apologize. But think back to Peg, okay? Fairly high-speed injury, reasonably, okay, for a gravity-powered vehicle. Fairly high-speed injury, fairly slim patient. That mechanism of injury is different than if that same, wow. I will get to English, folks, I promise, okay? If that same sledder were to hit somebody much larger, okay, it's the Yugo versus the semi kind of thing. That's your mechanism of injury. Last thing is number of patients, and that one's really important. I was a paramedic in downtown Spokane for a year, and we had an ambulance that got sent out to a rural call. It was a big old Lincoln, I think it was, that was barreling down the road. I apologize, I'll move over here for a while so you're not cranking your neck. Barreling down the road, and it was one of those farm country roads where it's going straight, and then it takes a jog around the house. Well, the big old Lincoln, the driver was drunker than you could believe, missed the curve completely. Just went straight off, nosedived into the ground. They found the car upside down in the bedroom of the trailer. Thankfully, everybody was still out and having their own alcohol in the living room of the trailer at that time, so nobody was hurt there. Crew gets on scene. They pull the driver out, start working on him. 15, 20 minutes later, one of the firemen is looking in the car, finds a hole in the passenger side windshield. When that car hit the ground, the passenger got launched, and this was enough speed where she went over the trailer, wow. And she was in a wad in the backyard. So number of patients is huge. It was probably 40 minutes after the accident before she got treated. So let's look at this picture. Somebody tell me the hazards, besides the big stinking hole.
The cornice they're standing on?
The cornice they're standing on, that's a good one. Okay.
The vehicle shifting.
Oh, yeah. And if you look at that, which way do you think it's going to shift? Is it just going to go straight in? Is it going to twist? Is it? What's it going to do?
Probably going to roll like towards us.
Roll towards us, kind of that front right down first.
Yeah.
Take a look at the back door of that thing. Yeah. What's it going to do to that dude in the white shirt?
Take him out.
Oh, yeah. Going to hit him right about waist level. Nice pelvis break. Oh, yeah. Okay? This is what I'm talking about by scene size up. You can look at that, and in 10 seconds, you guys got the gist of what could potentially happen here and what we need to fix with that guy in the white, what we're going to have to fix. Okay, now that we have what we're going, what our hazards are, let's talk about what we can find on our patient. Most of you guys, and me included, when I started medicine, we learned the ABCDE, airway, breathing, circulation, disability, or mental status, and expose your patient. In trauma, the military found this one, that this was a better way of looking at it, and it took a long time for it to process into civilian medicine. And you guys don't have to write this down. In fact, I will hand them out right now. I saw Nancy writing, so I just remembered. Please, take one and pass it around. These are cards that actually have this on it. You can throw them in your wallet. It has the MARCH acronym. It has your sample history for taking history. It has your mental status, your AVPU, and it has your secondary exam on there. So on the MARCH side, and where was I? Derailed my train of thought. Okay, there we go. I was a real skeptic on this. Like I said, it had been decades that I was in the ABCs. And once I started looking into this, a buddy of mine actually, in these classes, started teaching it. And it took me about 5 or 6 years of him teaching it to finally go, hey, wait a second, this makes sense. So this is why I'm teaching you guys this. It's just kind of another way to look at how you assess a patient. It works really well for trauma, also works for a medical type of patient. But here's kind of our order of operations, and this is where we talk about what you can fix fastest. How long does it take to fix a massive hemorrhage, especially if it's on a limb? Yeah, exactly. Yep. Your tourniquet, your pressure, 99% of the time pressure is going to work. And I'll show you how I treat folks excuse me, how I evaluate folks. It's really quick to do. But you could fix a massive hemorrhage real quick. How long does it take to fix an airway? And we'll talk more about this in a minute, but think on that. That's kind of the way this is going. It takes less time to fix the first two, little more time to fix these two, and these take forever to fix those last two. That's why it's organized that way. It's not necessarily what's going to kill them first. It's what can I fix fastest and get the most benefit out of. Let's look at massive hemorrhage. And before I go on, there is a picture on the next slide. Let me tell you, it's moulage. It's not real, okay? It's just Hollywood. You can see the tube going in there to make it spurt. It's just showing you what a massive hemorrhage is talking about. This isn't a little cut where it's oozing. This is things coming out in buckets. If you upend a gallon of milk on the floor, that's a massive hemorrhage, okay? That's the ones we want to fix. Oozes and little things like that, that's not going to kill them, at least not for a while. So first thing we do is find it. How do we find it?
You look for it.
Yeah. Holy cow, what a concept. I like that. Okay. This time of year, how much of a challenge is that?
Pretty hard. Clothing.
Oh, yeah. Lots of clothing. So what do we have to do? Not necessarily. And being a civilian medic and into the litigation system, I don't go down to skin very, very rarely, but I'll get down to the layer that's not going to absorb or that's not going to block everything. Gore-Tex is wonderful unless you're trying to evaluate a patient, then it really sucks because it becomes a big bag and just everything stays in there. Do you mind if I borrow you for a second? If you don't mind me getting hands-on.
Oh, well, I'll sit down.
He likes it.
All right. It is Eric, right? Okay, so for Eric, how much of a challenge do we really have assessing him?
Not much.
Okay, he doesn't leave much to the imagination. If this, as far as medical exam goes. Thanks, good catch for me. Okay, so if I'm going to examine, okay, this, is it going to hold blood?
No,
it's going to leak through fairly quickly. If he was wearing the Gore-Tex, I would have to get a little friendly. Now, what can we fix first? Can I fix this, or can I fix these?
Arms.
Yeah, you can fix limbs, so that's what I'm going to check first. And forgive me, I'm going to get a little friendly with you, okay? If you get it, if he's got a jacket like this, all I'm going to do, if it's loose enough, I get a hand inside, run it down, got no blood on that one. Legs, the same thing. If he's got Gore-Tex snow pants on, I'm usually going to come up from the bottom. With him, and forgive me, I'm going to get a little friendly here. Think about it. Where are the biggest vessels? They're right up here. So I'm going to get up friendly, and I'm just going to run all the way down. The last thing I'm going to do is open up and check torso. Around the backside, nothing. Thank you, sir. You are a good sport. Okay. That's all it takes. Now, if you got clothing on, the zipper's frozen, something, I can't get in there, and I have to cut clothing, think about this in a cold environment. If I cut along the zipper, what's going to happen to my patient every time I lay him down? Okay? If I'm going to cut clothing, I'm going to cut over on the side somewhere so I can open it up, do my exam, close it back up again, just like a blanket. You always, especially you guys know this, you're outside. It's cold out there. You gotta think about keeping your patient warm. You, as the treater, are running around like mad. You're jacked up like me on this coffee. You're staying warm. Your patient is for a reason, and we'll talk more about that in a minute. Okay? That's your exam. That's how easy it is to find those things. And as soon as you find one, if you come out and your glove is just soaked, that's something I want to look into further. If I have to cut it, whatever I got to do to get to it, I'm going to expose that with that jacket. If I just want to put a tourniquet on it, I'm going to open that jacket down the sleeve, I'm going to wrap my tourniquet around, and I'm going to pull it tight. I'm going to leave the jacket just like that. If it's tighter and I can't, yes, I'm going to have to cut it. But, excuse me, don't be afraid to use a tourniquet. Is that starting to... I know in the folks that I teach a lot of times, the tourniquet thing is starting to become more favorable, It used to be when I started learning that you never put a tourniquet on. That was bad juju. You just never put it on. Is that starting to permeate down to where it's more acceptable for you guys that are more into the medicine? Or is it still kind of...
Well, we try the pressure first, and then if that's not working...
Okay. But it's not the big bad...
Correct.
...taboo that it used to be?
Correct.
Good. I like it. The reason being, think about this. Has anybody... I've had a knee surgery. Has anybody else in here ever had an orthopedic surgery? Okay. Do you know how long your surgery was?
A year.
How long the surgery, yeah. The surgery itself, how long the surgery, the procedure was.
The surgery itself?
Yes.
I have no clue.
Okay.
About 4 hours.
Okay. Do you mind me asking, was it a knee?
I don't think it.
Oh, okay. A little different.
But it was different because I also had a rod in my femur.
Oh.
They had to take out first.
Oh, interesting. Okay. It was true shop class on that one. Okay. They did, on mine, they did an ACL, MCL, and meniscus. It took about the same, about 4 hours. And for that whole time, there's a tourniquet around my leg. 4 hours. Everything still works. I can still feel everything. The tourniquet is not the big bad thing we used to think it was, okay? If you have one bleeder, 9 times out of 10, actually 99% of the time, pressure is going to fix it, just like Nancy said. She's absolutely right. If I have more than one bleeder, there's a couple of things I'll do. While I'm checking my patient, I may kneel on that one bleeder so I have my hands, or I'll just real quickly throw a tourniquet on it so I can go on and treat other things. Depends on your patient. But don't be afraid of the tourniquets. And in Wilderness Advanced First Aid, we teach this all the time, there is a protocol for loosening a tourniquet in the field. If you're going to be there for long periods of time, there is a protocol. Would you like me to talk about that? Or would you prefer I did not?
Mm-hmm.
Yes. You two are the...
We have it for our wilderness first responders.
So you probably have the same protocol then. At 20 minutes, crank it down. If in 20 minutes the bleeding stopped, undo it. Is that the same... Or similar?
Yeah, I mean, we have a protocol where we can loosen it after a certain amount of time, whereas the wilderness first response class that we take says you can't ever loosen it.
Right.
But ours are different.
Perfect. I'm glad that's finally getting out, too. That's a very good thing. So I will let you, at your meetings, talk about that, but just know that it is possible. The tourniquet is not the big bad thing. It's not going to lose the limb. If they lose the limb, it's not because of what you did. It's because of the damage that was done before. Make sense?
Can you repeat what she said?
You're talking Nancy?
Yeah.
She was saying in the wilderness first responder classes, there is not a protocol, but for Holden, I'm assuming it's your preceptor gave you a protocol for it?
Yeah.
Yes. So there is a protocol in place to loosen it. Yep, but I'll let... my preceptor and her preceptor have different isms, and I don't want to put my preceptor's isms into the message. So I'll let Nancy talk about that to the folks that she wants to. Okay? Okay. If we can, pressure is the best thing. Put pressure on, wrap the wound, all done. If you can't and you don't want to put a tourniquet on, or it's an inconvenient spot, or you don't have a tourniquet, you can also pack a wound. And that is that a woofer also?
Yeah.
Okay. Have you guys ever seen how to pack a wound? Have you ever seen it done? Mm-hmm. Some have, some haven't. Okay. Can I borrow you for a second? It's actually a really easy thing. And this one, there are some things I like to show, and this is why I'm going to show this one. But again, don't do this one on your patient until you talk to Nancy. Okay, do me a favor. Just make a fist. Give me a little bit of a spot in the middle there for your wound, and put a fist underneath. Okay? Now, if I have a wound and I'm trying to stop it, even with a tourniquet, what am I pressing that vein against or artery against with a tourniquet?
Bone.
Exactly. So if I don't have one or I'm not willing to put a tourniquet on, I still need to push that against the bone. So if I am packing a wound, all I do is I take some clean gauze. I like Curlex just because there's lots of it in one roll, and I just start packing. Your patient is probably not going to like you because you are pushing down in a wound. Okay, if you do it quickly afterwards, they haven't started feeling it yet, but she is perfect here. Now, if I start pushing down, okay, go ahead and give me a little resistance here. Okay. If I start pushing down, I get into the wound, I want to keep the pressure, right? I don't want to ever take the pressure off. So if I'm doing that, okay, this is going to be really easy. If I take the pressure off, you're going to see it because she's giving me resistance. So as I'm packing this, all I'm doing is folding new gauze over top. As one finger's coming out, one finger's going in. And you just keep on going until you can't pack any more in there and there's not things leaking out. That's about all your fist is going to let me do. Okay? The rest of it, as I'm holding pressure, I just put that on top and I start wrapping my, I can wrap the cling, I can wrap ace, I can wrap whatever I want to over top, and I'll let you give your biceps a rest there. Thank you, ma'am. And from there, it's the same as any other dressing. All you're doing is putting something absorbable inside or on top and then wrapping with something that's elastic. Personally, I like the ace wraps. If it's all you got, use duct tape. Just remember that duct tape is going to eventually cause a tourniquet because of the swelling. But use what you got, okay? If you have a large bleeder, it's really, really, really good to secure it from movement. What am I talking about there? Splint. What else would we call that?
Splint.
A splint. Okay, why? Why would we want to do that?
Prevent further damage.
Okay, that's a good one. Why else?
Could you repeat what people say?
Oh, I'm sorry. Prevent further damage. I'm sorry? Somebody was saying something over here I didn't hear.
It was just another way of saying protect it from things if you're trying to, roots, branches.
Right.
Things, and also make other people aware that there's an injury.
I like that. Okay. She said, you got to move your patient out, so it's protecting it when you're beating around on branches, roots, all of those sort of things, and make somebody aware that there's a problem there. Okay? What happens when we move muscles?
Blood
gets sent there. Okay, your blood flow increases. All of those sort of things go into why we splint it. We want the minimum amount of muscle movement. We want to protect it. We want people to know that it's there. That's why we splint them. Wow, that sucker's bright. And I should know that, or apparently I'm not very. Okay, big thing, look for more. Just like we wanted to know how many patients there are, we want to know how many bleeders there are. Anything on massive hemorrhage? Tourniquet's not bad. Pressure fixes 99% of the things. You can pack it if you need. Okay, moving on. So we're off of the M, we're on to airway. Okay, what's our airway? And when airway, we're talking kind of everything above the lungs. If you think about it, isn't it just tubing? Okay. What plugs up tubing?
Stuff.
I like it. What kind of stuff typically plugs up our tubing?
Food.
Okay, food's a big one. How do we fix that?
Heimlich maneuver.
The hug from Hades. Mm-hmm. Yep, Heimlich maneuver. Okay. What else?
Gum.
Okay, fixed the same way. I like it. Yep, foreign bodies of some flavor.
Tongue.
What else?
Tongue.
Okay, that's our big one when we're talking patients that are unconscious and we're laying them on our back. Like we were all taught how to treat patients, we all lay them on their back so we can assess them the way we were taught, right? Okay, as soon as we lay them on their back and they're unconscious, that tongue flops right back. And for those of you that either are or have snoring husbands, that's the thing. Okay, so you just gotta roll them up on their side or do the head. No, anyway, sorry. Okay, so how do we fix that? How do we fix that? Red shirt. Okay, if it falls into the back of the throat laying on their back, how would we fix it? Roll them on their side. Some people call it the party position, okay, or the recovery position, whatever you wanna call it. It just rolls that tongue away. What is the head tilt chin lift that you learn for CPR? All you're doing, because the tongue is attached to the bottom jaw, you're moving the bottom jaw further away from the back of the throat. That's all you're doing. There are other things that we can use in medicine, the oral airways, the nasal airways, all those kind of things that do the same thing, but that's the easiest way to do it. Excuse me. And there is your roll it onto the side. Okay? Easy enough to fix airway stuff. It's just plumbing. Something clogged up the pipe. Before I moved on real quickly from food and I forgot. If you're doing the Heimlich maneuver and it's not coming up and your patient goes unconscious, what do you do? I'm sorry?
Chest compression.
Yeah. Move right into CPR. Put them on the floor, start doing CPR. Don't worry about the breaths because there's something in there anyway. Do your first set of 30, then take a look. This is the one time in CPR that you're allowed to look or you're allowed to do something about it. If you see something in there, pull it out. Don't go reaching, but if you see something in there, just reach in, pull it out, and away you go. If the breaths don't go in, get right back on the chest. Do your thing, okay? All right. Good on airway?
Mm-hmm.
Excellent. You guys are a good crowd. At least I get a north and south or an east and west. I like it. Okay. Respiration. And for those of you, I realize respiration is a little deeper in. It's a cellular level. This is ventilation, but the V doesn't fit into the acronym. Okay? So we're going to go with respiration. If you think about this, it's just a pump. It's a bellows pump. Just like somebody would use to work on a forge. I'm sorry?
Or play an accordion.
Or play an accordion. Same kind of thing, only we're going up and down instead of side to side. So what are really the three parts that make that pump work?
Ribs.
Okay, the ribs. That is the housing of your pump. That makes a fixed, basically, fixed size container. What's another piece?
Diaphragm.
The actual piece that makes it work, the muscular piece. And the third piece is just the lungs, our container. Okay? How this thing works is you have your pump, you have your diaphragm. Now, does the diaphragm, when it's relaxed, sit flat or does it sit domed?
Domed.
Right. Muscles, all muscles can do is contract. So as it gets shorter, it flattens out. So we have our container. The diaphragm flattens out, makes the size in here bigger. So it doesn't suck air in, it allows air to be pushed in. This gets kind of important here in a minute. That's why I'm going through this. Okay. For the most part, we just breathe. Your patient just breathes. It's kind of important here in a minute to know why and how they do that, okay? If something happens to either the muscle or the fixed size container, bad things go on. So what can go wrong with this system? What kind of injuries can your patient have?
Puncture.
Broken ribs.
Okay, let's start with a broken rib. We'll get to punctured here in a minute. Is a broken rib, unless it's broken bad enough where it like punctured into the heart, is a broken rib going to kill your patient right away?
No.
No. What is it going to do?
Be very uncomfortable.
Okay. I like that. So what's that going to do to your patient?
Make it difficult to breathe.
Right. Yes. It's difficult to breathe simply because it hurts. It hurts like mad. It leads to shallow breaths, hypoxia, all sorts of other things as time goes on, pneumonia, blah, blah, blah. Okay? In the time that we have our patient, the big part is getting them to breathe normally. How can we do that?
Rib.
I'm sorry?
Support the rib.
Okay, she says support the rib. How do we do that?
Chest wrap.
Okay. That was a teaching for a long time. Actually, it's been on and off a few times. Think about what happens if we wrap the ribs. Okay?
Compress the whole thing.
Yeah, you kind of squish the whole thing. And somebody that already has a sore rib and doesn't want to breathe deep now has problems breathing deep, and it just kind of compounds our problem. And that used to be the treatment of choice. I was taught that for years. A better thing, what's the patient going to do? Has anybody had a broken rib? There you go. Okay? Anybody that's had a broken rib knows the first thing they do is, ugh. Okay? Why do we need any other kind of splint? The worst or the most I'm going to do is do a sling around that arm and do a swath just to hold the arm against the chest. He's splinting it or she is splinting it exactly the way they want. They're making it the most comfortable for themselves. Let them do it. Make sense? Mm-hmm. Okay. If your patient's unconscious and you find a broken rib, while you're putting down into that recovery position, what's the biggest splint we have around?
The ground.
Roll them onto that affected side. That'll splint it. The ground will keep it in line with the other ribs and keep it to some extent from moving as much as possible. Excuse me. You can also use board splints and all sorts of stuff. You just kind of got to be careful on how you attach them. Okay, what else do we have for rib problems? You guys already got rib fracture? We'll get to the pneumothorax. Somebody said punctured lung. Anybody heard of a flail chest? Okay. Go ahead, Mark. Tell me about it.
Multiple fractures in adjacent ribs, so you have a chest wall section that's paradoxically breathing with your breaths.
There you go.
So it causes breathing difficulties.
Yes. This is where the structure of the chest comes into play. There you go. Exactly what Mark was talking about. The technical definition is two or more ribs broken in two or more spots. Okay? Exactly what Mark said. And what we're looking at is, if you think about it, we still have our fixed size container. We still have our motor to make it go. But now, when the motor goes, that piece, instead of being an integral part, now moves. So as that rib, or as that diaphragm is trying to let air in, your functional volume is gone on that side because the chest wall is moving and sucking in. The lung is not allowed to expand and pull air in. So you've lost that much functional volume. On top of that, nerves, arteries, and veins run right below. So you're, every time he's breathing, you're hacking at those kind of vital pieces. That's something we need to stabilize. And you stabilize it exactly the same way as you would any other fractured rib. It's just really important to make sure that it's stabilized. That's a lot of damage going on. Okay, last one. Who was the one that said punctured lung? Somebody back there. Oh, there you go. Okay, your hand was hidden by somebody else's head. Okay. Punctured lungs can happen spontaneously. They can come from trauma. There's a whole bunch of different ways. If you think about a traumatic one, typically it's something coming from the outside and making a hole in your chest. A stick, a stob, whatever. Think about when our skin gets ripped. There's a huge difference. When you're in the kitchen, you slip with a knife, it's a fairly nice, pretty wound. If something gets stabbed into you, skin tends to rip instead of nicely cut. The problem is your skin has a bunch of different layers. The outside layers just kind of get torn up as they go through. What happens, think about it, if you push something through a piece of paper. It makes kind of a flap, okay? So if I have a hole through the outside layers and a flap on the inside, remember how our chest works. It doesn't suck air in, it allows air to come in. Now I have a hole here. Every time that space inside expands, oh, my flap opens. And then the space inside stops expanding, my flap closes. And then it opens. Every time you breathe in, it's a one-way valve. Okay? Eventually, things like this start to happen. And you probably have more experience reading x-rays than me. Tell them about that. Can you see? Do you see what's going on there?
I don't know. Okay. I mean, I can see the pneumothorax on that one.
Mm-hmm.
This one looks like the, I mean, is that the heart? Because there's no heart board around this.
Yeah, like that's the heart.
Yeah.
Okay, heart normally sets right there. All of these tubes up here that connect the heart and the bronchi that branch off to the lungs run right down the middle. That's where they're supposed to be. Mm-hmm. As that pressure, because you got the one-way valve allowing air in but not out, as the pressure starts to build up, there's enough pressure there where it's pushing everything to the bad side or to the good side. Mm. So now not only is this lung not doing anything for us, but this lung's getting squished. So it's not doing anything for us either. Now, this isn't one of those things that you get shot, you're going to have, or stabbed or whatever it is. You wind up with a hole in your chest and you're going to die 5 minutes later. These take a while to build up. Think about it. You have a gigantic tube here that you're breathing with. You have a little spot on your lung that is wrongly breathing. It's going to take a while to build up. 45, 50 minutes is the typical amount of time. But what we teach is anything from clavicles to belly button, if they have a hole, put something on it, plug it. I don't care if it's duct tape, whatever you have, plug that hole. If you think about it, when your diaphragm is contracted, it can be down here at the bottom of your ribs. If they happen to be hunched over or things come at an odd angle, basically belly button to clavicles, that's, we call it the box, but it's, your lungs could be there, so plug that hole. Plugging the hole is going to stop the air going in. If you get all the holes plugged, you will prevent this problem from happening. Because, yeah, you still got a one-way valve, but there's no air getting past it or to it. Okay? If they get to this point, you will actually see their trachea moved over to the non-affected side. You'll see their neck all swollen up because there's so much pressure that blood's getting pumped to the brain, but it can't get pumped back down, so the veins just get full. It looks like a deer in rut. It's just this gigantic neck. That's bad. If we've let it go that long, we're way behind the power curve. Yes, ma'am?
And I imagine when you say plugging the hole, you're packing that.
In this case, nope. All you gotta do is put something over top. Yep. Duct tape is phenomenal, except for the fact that 9 times out of 10 our patients are sweaty or wet or something. So something that's gonna stick to that and plug the hole. Yes, ma'am?
How do you determine if there is something sticking out of it, like a stick?
If there's something sticking out of it, leave it there. Don't touch it, because that's plugging the hole for you. Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah, if you have something embedded in your patient, leave it there. If you have to move them, I mean, if it's a stick, you may have to cut it down, but leave it in there. Take your dressings, and they call it a volcano wrap. You wrap once around it, once around the patient, once around it, once around the patient. By the time you're done, it's this gigantic volcano-looking thing. I actually saw an ER physician do that with a patient who changed her mind in the middle of committing suicide and had a knife about that far into her abdomen. Mm-hmm. He couldn't see what it was, so he wanted to send it onto another one. And he, big knife, and it was volcanoed all the way out its length. Mm-hmm. She had a wrap about this big around her. She looked like she was wearing one of those life rings from a boat. Okay. There was something that sparked in my brain from, where'd she go? Your question. What was your question again? Yours was?
Oh, do you pack it or
plug in the hole? Yours,
you just duct tape, but.
Okay. Darn it. It was a brilliant thought, too. Absolutely profound. Oh, that's what it was. Okay, now I'm back on it. All right. The nice thing about the hole, if we haven't patched the hole, we can fix our patient with that same hole. In my ambulance or down in the clinic, I carry a big stinking needle that I go into the top of the chest and relieve the pressure. Okay? As a treater out in the field, we don't have that. But that hole that originally caused the problem, we can use to fix the patient. Now, if you think about it, and the old military training and probably the old medical training was, if you cover something, if they start developing a tension pneumothorax, I can just release it and let it burp. Okay, think about that. Is that going to work? No, because it's got that one-way valve on the inside. So what do we have to do?
Stick him in the hole.
We got to open the one-way valve. Remember how when we were packing the patient, I told you our patient wasn't going to like you? Mm-hmm. They're not going to like you for this one either, because you got to get something in there and open the one-way valve and let the air out. They're not going to like you, but until they realize that, oh, hey, I can breathe again. Okay? That's the only way in the field really to fix these without advanced equipment, okay? So if you have somebody that is showing signs of a tension pneumothorax, which means they're having increasing trouble breathing, they're turning blue, they're turning all the things that go along with being hypoxic, and you have holes up there in the box, chances are one of them is creating the pneumothorax, and you gotta get in there and open it up. Now, note to self, think about this. You have blood and all sorts of goo in there. You have a propellant with all the air that's in there. Don't get over top of it. It's just, don't do that. Get off to the side, open it up. That's the only way in the field to fix this. Okay. Yes, ma'am.
What about if there's a punctured lung, but it's from like a broken rib or something, and there's no outer hole?
There is one way we can treat that. There's two things to do. First, put them on that side. Whatever side their pain is on, put that side down so that you're not squishing the good lung. Put that side down. and it's Diesel and Noyce. Get them to somebody with many more letters behind their name than any of us. Okay? With a closed pneumo, that's, we can't do a thing in the field. Make sense? Mm-hmm. Excellent. Thank you. Good question. I forgot to mention that one.
If we're like trying to get that air out, mm-hmm. we're pushing a finger or something in there, mm-hmm. are we also going to push something else into the actual lung?
You try and make it as clean as possible, but this is, for me, as a paramedic, I treat what I see. I treat the symptoms. When I drop them off at the hospital, the doctors fix all the infections and all of the other pieces.
Whatever we put in there.
Yep. I'm going to make it as clean as possible. I'm going to do the best job I can, but I'm going to save their life by opening the hole and let the doctors. It's not like it used to be where an infection is going to kill everybody. Make sense?
Yeah.
Cool. Good question. I like that one. Okay. Circulation. The biggest thing we got here, we already fixed the holes. Okay. We already fixed whatever was bleeding and leaking out. So the rest of circulation comes down to things moving around and getting nutrients out to the cells. Nutrients and oxygen. Those are the two things your cells really need. There's more than that, but that's the two big things they need. Now, I apologize. This one makes me get up on my soapbox and dance around a little bit, so I'll apologize now, but I'm headed there. Okay. This is where I hate Hollywood. You look at any movie, you look at any show, and the doctor goes, oh, my patient's in shock. Okay, it's the only cause of death, the only one. There are many ways to get to shock, your heart attack, your fall off the cliff, whatever. But shock is the only cause of death. If your patient is in shock, you got to be moving. You got to be doing something. So, what does shock look like? If you're walking up to a patient, oh my God, what does it look like? Let's go through. I'll show you. Okay? Inadequate tissue perfusion, it's all that's saying is your cells aren't getting fed. That's all that really says. That's the Merriam-Webster or whoever's dictionary I pulled that out of. And there are many different kinds of shock. Hypovolemic, low volume. Neurogenic means your brain's not controlling what it's supposed to anymore. Anaphylactic, any questions on that one? Just a wicked allergic reaction. Okay, so let's look at shock. I was 10 years into medicine before and had heard of shock, and I knew shock was bad. But there was a brilliant doc that came up and showed us this representation of shock. And I was like, oh, good Lord, I should have thought of that years ago. So let's think about this. So I can't take credit for this one. This is Dr. Cunningham. But our circulation system is basically a closed system. There's a known volume of blood. There's a tank that's... Excuse me. There's a tank that is fairly well controlled in size, and there's a pump. So when everything's working well, that's our system. We maintain blood pressure, we maintain pulse, everything works just fine. Okay? What happens when we get a hole? Okay? We got a hole, drains something out, or we let ourselves get dehydrated, or whatever it happens to be, our volume is low. Okay? If our volume is low, our pumps... The easiest way to represent it is the pump is out of the fluid. Think about it. What happens to a pump when it loses prime? Okay, it doesn't pump. So what does that do to your blood pressure?
It drops.
Okay, what does that do to the speed of the pump? It spins faster. Okay, so pulse goes up, blood pressure goes down. If your pulse goes up and your pressure goes down, what does your patient's skin look like? Really. What's that?
It's got a clamminess.
Yeah, they're kind of cold because there's no circulation going, or very little. They're kind of clammy. What about the color?
White.
Yeah, that kind of pale, grayish, heart attack-y color. You just walk in a room and go, that color. Yeah, so pale, cool, and clammy with a high pulse, your patient's in shock. Unless you can prove otherwise to me, your patient's in shock. You should be doing something. We'll talk about the doing something here in just a second. But we got one more to look at. All right. Your pump is in the same place. You got the same amount of fluid, but now your tank's bigger. Okay, there's a couple of ways that can happen. An anaphylactic reaction can make your vessels open up. If all your vessels open up, where's all your blood? In your feet. Exactly. Okay? Neurogenic shock is kind of the same thing. Your brain loses control of the vessels. They open up. All your blood's in your feet. There's a couple other things that can do it. There's septic shock. There's things like that. But it's basically your body is losing control of the system, and all your blood's in your feet. But your pump's out of the fluid, same thing happens. Pale, cool, clammy. So what do? How do we treat shock?
Turn the bottle over.
Turn the bottle over. Exactly. That's what do we do? How do we treat shock with your patient? What do we do?
Lie down.
Feet up.
Okay, lying down, feet up. How high do we put their feet?
At least 12 inches above their heart.
Yeah, 6 to 12 inches. Yep. Okay. Do we put right on the end of the heels?
No.
No. Get back so you're under the knees. Let all that blood flow equally both ways. That's it. That's all there is to shock. So we've plugged the hole. Earlier on, we found all the holes and we plugged the hole. If you are going to be with your patient for a while, if you're in the village, you're treating for shock, you're calling Nancy and Mina and they're coming to fix it, don't give your patient anything to eat, drink, or be merry. If you are taking care of this patient for a while on your own, we still have to maintain hydration. Otherwise, it's just going to compound this whole problem. So the big thing with shock is plug the hole, fill the tank. If you have this patient for a while. Make sense? There's kind of two different scenarios here. Survivor versus in the village with a medic around the corner. Okay. Did that one help you guys as much as it helped me when I was a young medic? Excellent. I like it. And that's the big thing. My dance on the soapbox was very short, but the important thing is if your patient is pale, cool, and clammy, you need to be doing something about it. Very, very quickly. It will kill them. Okay, the H piece. There isn't just one thing that goes with the H part of your MARCH acronym. Oh my, we're running a little behind. Okay, with a head injury, what are you going to notice? What's the big thing you're probably going to notice about your patient, unless they're just unconscious or dead? If they're still conscious, what's the kind of the first thing you were going to notice?
They're acting loopy?
Yeah, they're acting different. I'll go that way. You may have this just butthead friend that's always a butthead and suddenly becomes the nice guy. Or the other way around. Yeah, that's the normal thing is you'll notice a personality change of some kind. Or they're just acting different. That's the biggest thing to find. What can we do for a head injury?
Not a lot.
Okay. What is it they're lacking? What's usually the problem?
Probably internal swelling.
Okay, and what's that, physiologically, what's going on when that's swelling?
Preventing adequate perfusion of blood to the brain.
There you go. Did you guys all hear that? There's swelling going on, or there's something going on in the brain that's preventing perfusion, preventing oxygen getting to the brain tissue. We can't, in a wilderness setting, give them more oxygen. What we have to do is decrease the need of it elsewhere. Okay? Keep them calm. Don't make them walk. All of those kind of things. Your head injury patient is now a stretcher patient. That's the only way to decrease the use of oxygen in the rest of the body and leave the most available for the brain. What little is getting up there. Excuse me. Or you can put them in that position. That'll get all the blood down there. But that one's a little hard to maintain. Okay. Hypothermia. Somebody tell me about it. What goes on in the body or what's going on? You're not talking yet.
No.
I'll pick on the non-talkers.
Yeah. It's really cold.
It's really cold. I like it. What happens as it starts getting cold?
Yeah,
you start to shiver. Okay, why?
Trying to warm up.
Yeah. Okay. So what is that doing to our stores?
Depleting the mass.
You're depleting your stores of energy and all the other pieces that you need to function. So as we go further down the line, hypothermia is a continuum from, hey, I'm having a good day, to, oh, crap. Okay? So as we move down that line, they're shivering. They're making their own, they're making their own heat. Then they start to run out of energy. What happens there?
They stop shivering.
Exactly. If your patient was cold and was shivering and is now not shivering and not sitting beside a fire, you probably should be doing something. Okay.
Sleepy.
Sleepy. sleepy, dopey, doc. No, sorry. yes. As they progress down, their energy is gone, so their brain has no glucose to work on. Their organs have nothing to work off of. So they progress down from really good day down that line to unconscious and dead. Okay? How do we stop that process? If we stop it while they still have energy, what can we do?
Get them to exercise?
Get them to move. Yes. Get them to create their own heat and then feed them. Okay?
Dry and insulated.
I'm sorry?
Get them dry if they're wet. Get them dry and get them insulated.
Oh, God, yes. Dry and insulated. Yeah. How fast or how much faster does wet clothing lose heat?
Lots.
Yeah, 25 times, not 25%, 25 times faster. Okay? Dry and insulated is huge. If you can, a fire. Fire is bueno. And I'll teach you some other ways to do it too. Okay, if they're to the point where they have no more energy, they can't make their own heat, what do we do? As a very last resort, yes, that was the thing I was taught too all the time. But remember that slide of
protect yourself.
Protect yourself. Thank you. I'm glad you know what I was talking about. Yes. If you give them your heat, now where are you? You got two really cold people. Okay? And you're not able to help them anymore. So between building a fire or using your candle inside of a heat wrap, something, you got to give them heat. Or you got to give them heat. What's the other thing you got to give them?
Energy
of some kind. So if I have a choice of warm water or a cold Pepsi, which one am I going to give them?
Warm Pepsi.
I like that. See, that's something that nobody ever comes up with. If I warm the water, I can warm the Pepsi. But anyway, most people don't come up with that. I like it. Okay? But yeah, absolutely. The Pepsi is the right answer, warm or cold. If you got a beer, it'll do the same thing. Okay? And they'll be happier about it. But you're just looking for giving them that energy. That's what they need, is the energy to be able to warm themselves up again. Cool? So, if our patient is getting goofy, I think that was the word you used. Goofy, loopy. Loopy. Yes, if our patient is getting loopy. I'm going to use the right terms here. If our patient's getting loopy, changes in mentation, changes in personality, that kind of thing, start thinking of this and get it fixed one way or the other. External heat source, energy, whatever it is. And some people are just more prone to it. It's just the way they are. It can be rapid weight loss. It can be a lot of things. But some people are just more prone to getting hypothermic. All right, last thing is help. We kind of talked about it earlier. Get help coming to you. However that is, if you're hiking up here, getting help coming to you, maybe sending somebody out to get it. But somewhere or another, get help coming to you. All right, real quick here, because I'm about 15 minutes behind. We got a long way to go and a short time to get there. Primary survey. Okay, we talked about this, but the one piece we didn't cover was always, depending on your mechanism of injury, think about the C-spine. Think about spinal injury. Is that really important if they're going to die because of the hemorrhage? No. We're going to fix the hemorrhage. We're going to fix the airway, breathing, circulation, all that stuff first. But we kind of want to have that in the back of our mind so we're not doing things that we don't have to that spine. Do your blood sweep just like we showed, only usually they're a little more horizontal when we do a blood sweep. Okay? Your MARCH acronym, and then decide. Okay. If I got a bunch of people in the group, I decide, okay, are we going to haul this guy out right now, or are we going to sit in place and send somebody out? This is where the injuries make your decision. Do I want him moving without more people? Do I want to keep it getting warm right now and then haul him out? That's kind of your decision process on what am I going to do next. And then your secondary survey. Secondary survey is nothing more than when you get to it. Nothing more than putting hands on everything from the head down to the feet. Right before you get to that, get your vital signs, pulse, mentation, respiration, skin temperature, and condition. Those are the ones that you can get without tools. Get those immediately. That way you have that baseline. You know, okay, here he is at this time. Without that baseline, you have no idea if what you're doing was making it better or worse. So get that first step of vital signs, so you know. History is really important. On the back of those cards I gave you, you'll see a little acronym that says sample. That's the questions that their doctor is going to want to know when they get to the hospital. And even if what they say doesn't make sense to you, it's some disease, some weird, wild disease that they caught in the Congo somewhere, that's okay. You may be the last person to talk to a conscious, and whoever they get to on the other end is going to want to know that weird, wild disease that they got in the Congo. And you getting the history may have just saved their life. Very important piece. And then we get down to the actual physical exam, finding everything else that's wrong that's not going to kill them in the next 5 minutes. Make sense? Excellent. And planning beforehand is one thing, but planning during the event, we'll talk to you here in a little while. Okay, your thought process. Big thing. Look around you. I used to watch this in folks that were training to be survival students. It was hilarious. These kids have been out in the woods for a week. They'd already gone through firecraft, sheltercraft, food, all of this stuff. And they're 18, 21-year-old kids. But they would get, I mean, they're in training for 6 months. So this is just their first phase of training. And they would get standards. Their instructors would come out and say, okay, you have to do a fire. It has to be made out of natural materials. It has to be started with natural materials. You can't use this. You can use that. And they get this whole litany of stuff that they have to do. And the instructor says, you have half an hour, go. And 9 out of 10 of these kids will take off running into the woods. And you see somebody that's had a little bit more experience behind them go, It's observing what's going on. Taking that moment, breathe, and figure out what you need to make life easier for yourself.
Okay.
Talk about look for resources now. What are some barriers? What are some internal barriers?
Your confidence.
Ooh. Okay. Confidence in what?
Your ability to survive and like think things through and see everything there is and trust in yourself.
Okay. I like it. What else?
Your ability to learn from failure.
Oh.
Just your patience.
Oh, darn it, I didn't do that right. That tree just shed on my fire. Now what do I do? Have you guys ever read To Build a Fire? Mm-hmm. Jack? Yeah.
There you go.
Okay. Yes, ma'am. Yes. Oh, yeah.
But I never really come to the real life sort of situation where I need to perform.
Are you related to my wife? That's something I hear when we're going out shopping. But sorry, I pick on her, but she's a great lady. I love her to death. Yes, that is one of the biggest internal barriers is, can I do this? And you've probably heard of, with all of our information technology, analysis paralysis. Mm-hmm. Same kind of thing out there. Oh, my God, it's just completely overwhelmed by what's going on. Okay. There's one. Yes. Okay. That is where a lot of people get in trouble. I can't do this. Or I don't want to do this. Or I don't know how to do this. And they don't try. There's one in. This is going to be a sensitive subject. And I'm going to bring it up anyway. And if I piss people off, I apologize. But this is one time. I read on something this morning. What is it on the bottom of your little card? Reforming? Yes, thank you. I read that this morning. And it's something I absolutely believe in. I won't kill anything. Okay, I'll go to the store, buy things, or get dead. But I don't kill anything that I don't have to. Green, furry, I don't care. Okay? But in this situation, I will have to take down critters. I will have to take down a tree, something. I am fighting Mother Nature at this point, and I am not going to let her win. So that's one internal barrier that is mine that I have problems with. Okay? I have to do this. I have to do that. Because it's me or my nature at this point. Make sense? Okay. External barriers. What do we got?
Climate.
You are great. You have been helping me all day. I'm going to pick on some of the people that aren't talking. External barriers.
Water. Waterways in your way.
Ooh. Okay. What's...
You can't cross a stream without getting wet.
I like it. Okay. So you are thinking, what's the thought process there? What's the problem with...
So like Railroad Creek runs down the valley. You have to get across it at some point.
Mm-hmm.
And
what's the danger to that?
Hypothermia.
Okay, hypothermia. If it's not quite so snowy, a little bit warmer, what else? Okay, the danger of getting sucked down the lake through all those snags and crap that's between here and there. What else?
I mean, just the fall in general.
Yeah, it's a danger. I don't care what time of year it is, that's a dangerous creek to cross. Mm-hmm. It looks nice and gentle and pretty and peaceful, but I've crossed stuff like that. It's, yeah.
Rocks are
slippery. Yep. And as a survivor, remember, as a medic and a survivor, what is goal number one?
Protect
yourself. Yep. In survival, we call it maintaining 98.6. That's your goal. Maintain 98.6 for you and whoever you're with. Okay? If you're crossing a creek, it's the hypothermia, it's the crossing, it's the whole thing. There are barriers to you. What are the kind of external barriers that they have? White, pink, shirt? I can't tell what that is.
Just other terrain barriers if you're somewhere that's hard to get out of or...
Okay. Yep. The terrain can be a barrier if you have to travel. I like it. What else?
What about cold?
I'm sorry?
Temperature?
Oh, yeah.
Cold outside.
Either way.
Things are freezing up. Your hands are freezing up.
Mm-hmm. And it can be either way. It can be the middle of August and 100 degrees. You ran out of water 2 days ago. Or it can be this time of year and freezing. Yes, ma'am.
Time of day.
Ooh.
Which light you have or don't.
Okay. I like it. Explain that a little further.
I guess if it's getting on toward evening, you might make some different assessments than if it's sunrise and you know you've got the full day of light.
I like it. And we'll talk more about prioritizing our time here in just a little while. I like it. Any other external barriers that you guys can think of?
I have to think of physical limitations, but I think that could be internal and external.
Yeah.
Like my body can do more than I think my body can do sometimes.
Yep. And the opposite of that is also true?
Yeah.
Your body may not be able to do what you think it can, especially as we get a little older. I'm no longer 20. I can't do that anymore. Okay? I like it. You guys are thinking through the process. That's what I'm trying to get going here. And that's why I'm picking on the people that don't talk, is it gives the rest of you time to think, too. All right. So, your mindset going into this, okay? My paradigm has just shifted. Whatever happened, the building collapsed next to me, a plane hit the tower, I got stuck, my partner got injured, whatever it is. Yes, ma'am.
Back a slide.
Sure. Oh, thank you. Now I'm going to put that down so I quit doing that. Okay. Whatever just happened to put me in this situation, we need to stop. We need to be that guy that goes, okay, there's my tree, and away I go. We need to slow down. Okay. Now is not the time, for a variety of reasons, to run amok. Okay. The next one here talks into kind of what you guys were talking about. The second piece, you got to perceive, okay, I can see what's going on. I have to believe that I can do it, and then I got to do it. Okay? It's not just enough. My wife gets on me all the time because I believe that I can get a project done. I do, and I can get the project done. It's the act part that I have problems with. I have 40 projects that are started, okay? The act part, get your shelter done. Don't start your shelter and go on to something else. Get your shelter done. Get your fire prep done. Perceive, believe, act. Okay? Impulsive behavior. This is where you stop and think, then do something. Don't run around like an idiot for a couple of reasons. One, and we'll talk about it here in a minute, we conserve sweat, not water. Move slow. Do your thing. I'm sorry? Oh. I heard something that I thought was a voice. Okay? Apparently I'm hearing things too. Okay? Be humble. This is kind of what we were talking about with the body. Be realistic of what you can do. You may be the greatest at whatever your job is in the village or whatever your job is in real life. you may have challenges as a survivor. It's time to be humble, realize, I may have to back off that just a little bit, reassess. That task didn't go quite the way I wanted it. Talk about being accept our failures and learn from them. I haven't got to English yet. But be humble. Start back. Realize it is something new, and away you go. Have you guys ever watched Bear Grylls? Alrighty.
Nothing wrong with him, but Auntie Bear, like, no.
Okay. Let me ask you this. Compare this sentence to this guy.
Is he really that bad?
Yeah. Probably the second or third episode I ever watched of him, he was out somewhere, it was a really rocky country, and he has a cliff here, a big stinking rock with 50-foot drop on either side, and then a cliff over here, big river down in the bottom, and he has to get across. Okay? Remember rule number one from the medical thing, protect yourself first. Mm-hmm. So Bear, as a survivor, takes a running leap off one cliff, lands on the rock 15, 20 feet away. Takes a running leap off of that and lands on shore. Great. He is in shape. He has a backup crew a mile long. I've actually read a story on the survival instructor gal that keeps him alive. Oh, she's awesome. She is just a studette. She's great. If you guys want the magazine, I'll bring it up sometime. She is awesome. Great gal. But that's what keeps Bear alive, not Bear. Just from maintaining 98.6, no impulsive behavior, that's why I say anti-Bear Grylls. Slow down. You have to keep yourself in one piece first. That's the only reason I was going there. Okay. Your physical condition, we've kind of beat on that one already. Think of location, okay? If I am at Holden Lake, something happens to me, I'm stuck there. What has to go through your mind, my mind, whatever? What kind of conditions do I have and what are my challenges?
My first thought would be, like, how long is it until somebody notices that I'm gone, and how much time do I have before someone else comes?
Ooh, I like it.
And if I don't know that, like, if I'm going to be here for a few hours or even days, like, how do I get myself into a place where I'm stable and safe?
Okay. Do you guys have, and I honestly, I don't know this, do you guys have a sign-up?
Yes.
Okay. Did I hear a no somewhere? Okay, I'm sorry. I thought you guys did, but I could have sworn I heard a no over there somewhere. Okay. Who checks that sign out?
Mark person.
Okay. When do you check that sign out?
At dinner.
Okay. So how long does it take to get from here to Holden Lake?
Depends who you are.
Oh, you got a good point. Depends on who you are. Okay.
2 to 4 hours.
And what time?
2 to 4?
That's the kind of average of...
Okay.
Throughout the summer, it seems like.
So somebody goes up, and I'm not bagging on your system here at all. I am just I'm kind of leading you guys down a path on what to think here. But somebody leaves right after breakfast, and they're in good shape. They hike up to Holden Lake in a couple hours. They're up there doing what they do. Noon, something happens to them. Dinner time, Nancy goes, "Hey, wait a second. This one hasn't signed back in." So dinner time this time of year, 5:30, you check in?
Yeah.
Okay. So from noon till 5:30, you're sitting in the snow. Hopefully doing some shelter, fire, food, water, all of those kind of things, waiting on somebody to come get you. This comes into your time of day. This comes into the communication, because now that list is your communication. Okay? What kind of things do you have to do up there to stay alive until, well, if you read it at 5:30, get up there, get a team together, get gear together, get up there 7:30, 8 o'clock?
Not this time of year.
Okay.
Yeah. Morning.
All right, let's go a little bit, other time of year. But, okay, so now you're out there overnight. What kind of things do you have to think of? What's goal number one? 98.6. Yep. Okay, we're going to talk through all the other pieces, but your location, your timing, how you communicate. And one thing I'm going to push, and I'll do it right now, is beyond the list, within your group of folks, whoever you are on your day off, whatever it is that you're taking the hike or wherever you're going outside of here, is something that we call an emergency action plan. And when I travel, I give it to my wife. Here you go, honey. I'm gonna do this. I'm gonna travel to here. At this time of day, I should be here. I'll give you a call. If I don't, here's what I want you to do. And it's just as simple as that. In the military, it's this gigantic form that you fill out for 3 days and needs signatures from God and everybody. But it's as simple. That's all it needs to be is I'm going here. I'm gonna be doing this. I expect to be back at this time. If I'm not by this time, come get me. Something went wrong. And even if they meet you on the trail back because you decided to fish or look at birds or whatever it is a little bit longer, great. That's fine. But at least you have something coming. And like I say, I'm not begging on your system at all. It's a good system. It's actually better than what we have down at the house. So I applaud you for that part. But you got to think of that system, whatever it is, here versus downtown Minneapolis, wherever you find yourself surviving. Alrighty. If I were to ask you guys right now what you have in your pockets that would help you survive, what do you got?
Cell phone. Earplugs.
Okay. Hold up. Cell phone. Granted, in this environment, is that going to help you? No. But in a lot of environments, it will. Okay? I hate technology, so I don't like cell phones. I don't carry cell phones most of the time, but it's a downfall of mine. I should fix that. I actually rely on my wife. She carries hers all the time. But it's a phenomenal thing to carry. You can get GPS off of them. You can get comm off of them. There's all sorts of things that they're good for.
Flashlight. The camera can be used to assess yourself, too.
Interesting. See?
You can keep track.
No.
I like it. See, that's things I hadn't thought of. I like it. Okay? Do you have places that you can't see? Mm-hmm. I like it. I told you I always learned something. Okay. What else you got?
Pen and paper.
Ooh. How's that going to help you?
Just write some notes along the trail and leave them on. Or start a fire.
Mm-hmm. There you go.
My heart rate. Or...
Yeah. Track the vital signs of your patient. Yeah, it can be fire starter. It can be all sorts of things. It can be the boredom killer. I will tell you what, one of the biggest things that people have to overcome in a survival situation is being stuck and being bored and not being able to do a darn thing about it. Type A personalities and survival just don't get along real well together. They got to be doing something. So writing your memoir so when you get rescued, you can write your book, make your millions. There you go. That's what your notebook's for. But yes, there's many uses for them. Notebook and pencil. If you have to navigate, notebook and pencil are absolutely invaluable. You have to have one. You guys can see I carry one of the Write in the Rain ones. And I carry a pen in my pocket. But with the Write in the Rain book, I always carry a pencil. Because if you break a pen, it's done. If you break a pencil, okay, now I got two. Great. I can do that. And I got my pencil sharpener to sharpen it. What can we do for sustenance? Do we carry it? Do we find it out there?
Yes. Both.
What's that?
Both.
Yeah. That's the best thing to do. Carry light stuff. Carry high fat stuff. Those are the biggest things. If you are a big carb intake person, I don't know how you guys do for diets. I'm not here to assess that. But if you're a big carb intake person, make sure you're carrying carbs. Otherwise, your body's going to go through a really tough change when you switch from carb inputs to fat inputs. But make sure you, whichever one you do more of, carry more of that one. The fats will give you longer lasting energy. The carbs will give you faster energy, if that makes sense. So, yeah, either carry it or be prepared to procure food out there. Plants. There's, given the Creek Valley, there are a lot, there's cattails in places, not too many. Those things are phenomenal food. You get down to the root, there's more starch and more carbohydrates in that root ball than there is in a potato the same size. Mm-hmm. It's like two or three times the amount. Those things are phenomenal. Cattails are great. They're fire starter, they're shelter, they're food. That's a great plant. Okay, what do you got for signaling comp? Do you guys have anything on you besides your cell phone?
Radio.
Okay. How far up the valley do those reach?
Ground quite fall, some conditions.
Okay.
6 miles.
Okay, thank you.
You could use your cell phone screen as a signal mirror.
Ooh, I like that. What do you have to know to use that?
A little bit of Morse code.
Okay, potentially. Or you could just be showing a location.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But you kind of got to know who's looking for you. Hmm. Yeah, am I flashing to the ground? Am I flashing to the air? Am I flashing? Yeah. Mm-hmm. You got to have an idea. Yes, sir?
I think on that, they're kind of a semi-universal code, like
three flashes. Yep.
I don't know what one and two are, though.
I don't know. I've never heard. I just know the three shocks, three flashes, three rocks, whatever. Yeah, three of something. That's the universal distress. Okay? Actually, I got off my subject. What else do you got in your pockets that you can survive on?
Pocket knife.
Okay. What is that useful for?
All sorts of stuff.
All sorts of stuff. I can dig out splinters. I can cut line. I can start making my shelter. Slice your apple, yep. He's food procurement if you're going full Rambo, I guess, or Bear Grylls. Whichever. Yep. Yeah, that is invaluable. Unless I'm flying, I go nowhere without some flavor of knife in my pocket. Whether it's this one, I got one of the Leatherman squirts. I love these little things, just the tiny ones. And, yeah, we'll get to that in a minute. Sorry. What else?
Belt.
I'm sorry?
A belt.
Ooh. I like it. Tell me some uses.
It's a tourniquet.
Okay.
Or some sort of brace if you need to make a splint with some sticks. Wrap it around. If you're, I don't know, you just need it as like a harness or something.
Ooh, carrying your supplies, carrying whatever. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I like it. What else?
Chapstick.
Okay. What uses you got?
Fires. You can use it to cover wounds. You can use it to keep your lips from getting chapped.
Yep. Any of the Vaseline-based ones are a great fire starter. They are phenomenal. Just make sure you start the fire, then put it on your lips. But yes, they're awesome fire starters. What else you got?
Got a watch.
You got a watch? Okay. What uses you got?
See how long you've been away. While you're waiting.
Ooh, okay. So part of your timing, yeah. Am I getting close to where I got to start really thinking about night coming on? Okay. There are ways to navigate with that, with your watch. Depending on your hemisphere and all sorts of things, you can actually find due south with your watch. So it'll help you navigate. Granted, navigation in this valley is fairly easy. You're either going to go east or west or uphill. But outside this valley, yeah, you're absolutely right. What else you got?
My watch has a beacon, too.
Okay.
So I can pull that pen out.
Oh, what manufacturer is that one?
It's the Breitling.
Oh, I haven't heard of that one.
It has a
okay.
What did you fix?
It has a signal, a beacon.
Mm-hmm.
So it's an aviator's watch, so if you pull it out, basically.
Who gets the
come to get you.
Who gets the signal for that one? Do you know?
I'm not exactly sure.
Okay. Yeah. Some of them go to the, yeah, some of them go to the National
some
Rescue Coordination.
You, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I like that. And some of those, I mean, you have the spot trackers, you have things like that that'll send out your location. I think Garmin now has one. I can't remember the name of it, but same kind of thing. The Garmins and the spots will go to whoever you program.
Right.
And that one will go whoever it's programmed to,
yep.
NRCC or something like that. Okay, what else?
Bandanas.
Okay, what you got there?
It's good for a lot of stuff.
Like what?
It could be tying a few of them together to do sling and swath for that broken rib.
Good one. That is one of my favorites.
Or tying around a wound as kind of, you don't have an ace wrap, wrap that around.
Okay.
Wetting your nose.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Filling a wound.
You could use it for packing a wound. Yep. What could you use it for? What can you use a bandana for water procurement?
You could wipe goo off plants.
Yep. What was his name? The pilot in Bosnia. Scott. God, I can't remember his name. Scott was his first name. He was a pilot. And the only thing, the only two things he did right was he took the sponge out of his kit. And that's how he stayed alive, was wiping dew off the plants and wringing it out in his mouth in the morning. The other thing he did right was he actually was able to find the rescue zone. That was it. Everything else he did wrong. But, yes, that was his big thing, was staying alive by wiping the dew off. How else can we use that for water procurement?
You can filter debris out of it.
Or there you go.
Large debris.
Yeah. You won't get rid of the Giardia and all of the other little critters, but you'll filter it out to make it slightly more palatable. If I were you, I'd hope I was upstream of the village to get water out of the creek, but yeah, you won't filter any of that stuff out. But yes, that's a good water filter for big stuff. You can actually use it. There's a way to do it. Any precipitation is assumed clean water. So rain, snow, any of those. Granted, snow that's been on the ground a while is different, but new precipitation is presumed clean because basically it's been distilled. None of the funky stuff goes up in the air with it. Did I see a hand up somewhere? Yes, ma'am.
So we are willing to take the risk of Giardia, or are we, like, depending on time? Like,
depending on time.
By tomorrow, someone will be here.
Yes. If you are somewhere in this valley and Nancy has read her list and knows, or you were on her list and she knows that you're missing, I'd have to be really, really, really desperate for water at that point.
But if we don't quite know, there's a river, we have a bandana,
yep.
But no iodine, where
yep. You gotta
assess the situation.
You got to maintain 98.6, and the only way to do that is water.
Okay.
Yep, 3 minutes without air, 3 days without water, 3 months without food. Yep. So, yeah, make
3 months?
Hmm?
3 months without food?
I'm trying to remember the exact
weeks.
Thank you. Okay, one small denomination there. Thank you. Anything else? What else you got in your pockets?
Scarf.
What's that?
A scarf.
A scarf. Okay. Same kind of. Oh, interesting. Okay, you can take out the big chunks with that one. Slightly smaller chunks with that one. You got a multi-layer filter. I like it. What else you got?
A lighter.
A lighter. Ooh. I tell you what. Yeah. I always carry two, usually. I got one in my pocket. I got one in my pack. In this case, my main one is running out, so I have two in my pocket. But I don't go anywhere except... Actually, I can carry that flying. That's right. I don't go anywhere without a lighter. I have a lighter in my pocket in shorts. It's just one of the... I don't go anywhere without them. Anything else? What else you got?
Hand cream.
Okay. What's it based, you know?
Beeswax, olive oil, and honey. So you can eat it if you want to.
You can. You can put it on some of the... have you guys heard of goat's beard, witch's hair, stuff hangs off the trees? You can get some of that stuff, put some of the wax around it, and it will... Because if you just try and light the goat's beard and witch's hair, it goes up like straw. And it's done. You can put some of that on it, on an end of it. It'll slow down the burn and let it catch more of your tinder. That's a good use for that one. Anything else? What else you guys got in your pockets?
Wallet.
A key.
Keys, wallet. Okay. Well, money's burnable.
You could use your credit cards for scraping or cutting at things.
Oh, God, yeah.
Have a knife.
Yep. Yeah, if you want to start a fire, all you have is your credit card. You want to get some of the pitch off of the tree, because the pitch on these fir trees out here, the pitch is just phenomenal. That stuff will burn forever and burns hot. You can gather it with that so you're not all sticky. That's a good one. Anything else?
Lint.
Lint. There you go. Fire starter. Okay. You guys can see it's just taking what you have and figuring out what you can do with it. If you plan ahead, it's great. I got all this stuff in my pockets. Okay, cool. That's probably the time I won't have a problem. It's when I don't have it and I got to come up with, okay, I got a little bit of pocket lint, I got a key, I got, okay. Those are the kind of things you're thinking of, that resourcefulness to come up and figure out what you're going to do with. Okay? Like I said, in this valley, knowledge and navigation, we shouldn't have an issue with that. Like I said, you're either north, south, or uphill. If you're west of town, go east. Go downhill, if you're, that kind of thing. It's not hard. Outside of here, I'm not going to get into navigation today, but there is a resource over here a friend of mine wrote that is the definitive. If you want to learn anything about any flavor of compass, that's the book to do it. He'll teach you everything. And it's, he was an Army guy, so it's broken down into Army simple. Even I can learn from that book. Okay? It's a good one. There's many other places, but if you're outside of here, I would get a little bit, either learn a GPS. I don't like GPSs simply because the batteries run out, they get cold, they die. I learned the compass. That doesn't die unless I break it, and that's why I carry a couple. I have a big one, and I have a little one, and I think I have a spare one in my other pack. Okay, the first piece of equipment. The most important piece of equipment is you. Got to have your abs. Got to have, you know, summer body, winter. Okay, it's time. Anyway, sorry. Okay, we talked about it before, but we only have so much energy. Depending on how we treat ourselves, between exercise and all the other pieces of how we treat ourselves, is how much we have left. Those that are in shape, have more stamina, workout, those kind of things, you're going to have a little bit more energy, you're going to have a little bit more time and availability of keeping yourself alive. Otherwise, it's just the energy that you got on you or the energy that you carry in your pack, whichever way you go. Okay? We talked about this a little bit earlier, but manage your sweat. Another way to put it is conserve sweat, not water. Put all the water that you can get down your neck. Work at a pace where you're not sweating. In this kind of weather, that is imperative. When I went through Arctic survival, their mantra was to sweat is to die in the Arctic. That's it. Like Mark said earlier, your clothes get wet, whether that's from the outside or from the inside, it still loses heat. Okay, you got to find a way at that point. And actually, I did this. I was teaching up in Colorado in the Rockies, about 10,000 feet. And my partner was teaching at the time. I was prepping for sheltercraft and firecraft, and we had about 4 feet of snow on the ground. I'm running around getting stuff ready. And by the time I got ready for the lesson that I was going to teach, I was freezing because I'd been sweating. I'd been working. I forgot to layer down. All the things that I teach, I forgot to do. And I was a wreck by the time I got to students. I was just freezing because all of my gear was wet. I had slowed down, prepping little stuff, and oh, God, students were just howling looking at me. It's very easy to do. That's why we talk about the impulsive actions and all those things. Slow down, stop, think, manage your sweat, okay? Keep the water inside and let it go out in its natural ways that it's supposed to, not out through your skin, okay? Injuries and blisters, treat those immediately. If you catch the hot spot, it won't become a blister. If you let it go to a blister, you're going to be slowed down. You're not going to be able to move and do the work and all of those kind of things, or any injury. Blisters are just a good example. If you don't treat the blister, it becomes basically a hole in your foot, a sore that now slows you down more and hampers you more, and becomes, if you're out there long enough, it becomes infected and becomes that sort of problem. Treat that stuff on yourself and whoever's with you immediately, okay? And personal hygiene. If you're clean, excuse me, if you're clean, you're healthy, you survive better and longer. And it's not real hard to take a snow bath, those kind of things. Just have your fire going to keep you, or get you warm again. Now, the other kind of equipment. A couple of little rules here. Get quality equipment. I held up the Leatherman Squirt. For a long time, I was going cheap. I'd buy whatever little multi-tool I could find, and after buying about a dozen of them, because I'd try and use them on the fire starter, and the blade would go this way, and the knife would go that way, and I get the Leatherman Saw, Gerber, whoever your manufacturer of choice is. Just get quality stuff is my point, okay? Test it first. We were playing outside with the fire starter. Make sure you can use it. What's your name? I'm sorry.
Becca.
It's my niece's name. She wanted to know how to use it. Great. We'll take it outside and we'll play with it. Get your tools. Play with them. Make sure you know how to use them. Maintain them. They're nice and clean and sharp and easy to use. Okay? Everything except a couple of things. The only thing I will say has one use is my metal match. That's about the only thing that has one use. And maybe my water tabs. Everything else I can use for a whole bunch of stuff. I have a signal mirror. I have, compass tenders. Everything has more than one use. Even one of my signaling pieces here, this is a good signal. Anything in the sun, it flashes. It's also sticky on the back. I can plug a hole in the chest. It's medical. It's signal. And then I can use my patient as a signal. Anyway. Okay. Jonah noticed it earlier. I carry a waterproof bag full of batteries. And I have two types. I have AA's and I have AAA's. All of my gear uses one of those two batteries. I don't buy the stuff with the special little button watch batteries and all of that kind of stuff. It's just over-the-counter stuff that I can get anywhere, recharge anywhere if I have to. And away I go. And the biggest thing, practice using it. If your your tinder kit sits in your bag year after year after year, I guarantee you when you go out to try and use it, you're going to have trouble. A couple weeks ago, my last trip up here, I actually came up and got a fire together and practiced doing the fire in the conditions up here so that when I demo it for you guys tomorrow or the next day, I don't look like an idiot. If you don't practice it, it's going to go away. And I've been doing this stuff a long time. Okay, here we go. This is what we were talking about with the timing. These are, I left medical out of this because it kind of transcends it and kind of interrupts all of this stuff. That's the only other thing. But these are really what you need to do as a survivor. Time of day is going to tell you a lot of how you do this. Okay? So if we get lost, let's see, we're almost out of time. We got lost, we got separated, we got injured outside right now. What would you guys prioritize? What would you say is number one?
Probably signaling communication.
Okay. How long does that take?
It depends entirely on what method you have of communication.
I like it. I hate giving that answer to you guys, but you're absolutely right. It depends. Yep. Do I have some marked flagging tape? I'm going to flag where I left the trail to go find supplies, resources. Am I going to put a big signal out in the snow for aircraft coming over? It all depends exactly on what you're going to do. So we got a signal out there. What's next?
Fire.
Okay. Why fire over shelter? I'm just curious. I'm devil's advocating here.
I just like being next to a fire.
There you go. Honestly, we call it the survival TV. Because you can sit there. How do you change the channel? Oh, cool. Okay, flame comes out this side now. It's great. Fire is the most useful tool probably that you have out there. You can purify water. You can cook food if you have to. It's warmth. It's company. It's all of those things. Fire is great. I love it. Okay, so we got shelter, food, and water left. And it's 11 o'clock in the morning. You guys are quick, because in the last 5 minutes, you've done signal and you've done fire.
Probably water.
Okay, why? I'm just curious.
You know, you might not need food for a couple of days, but you're going to need water a lot sooner.
Yep, exactly. And depending where we're going for our training area tomorrow and the next day, it's going to be, other than melting snow, if you're trying to get water out of the creek, it's going to be hard. Because you're yay far above the creek, and there's no way down without push. So, yeah, water may be a challenge. If you have a fire going and you have a pot, it's easy. Just melt snow. Don't drink snow, or don't eat snow cold. Don't do that. Melt it first. Otherwise, it's taking all of your energy just to warm up the snow before it can be any good to you. But, yes, water may be the next thing. Okay, so shelter or food? Which one are we doing next?
Shelter.
Okay, why?
Because you can go 3 weeks without food.
Okay, I'll go with that. And we got, 7 hours till dark. Okay, I'll go with that. So.
I'd say food.
Okay, go ahead. Why?
Because if we're right out here, we've got a crew that we know is going to come and get us, and it's going to take a ton of our energy to build a shelter. Whereas if we're sitting by our fire, melting some water and eating our food, we're maintaining the energy that we have.
Okay, I like that. Did you guys hear what she said? It may take, depending on your circumstances, it may take a ton of energy to make your shelter. So she's thinking, get the food first, maintain your energy, while you're building the shelter. If you decide to go with procuring food, it takes a fair amount of energy to procure food. Whether you're digging cattail roots or whatever it is that you're doing, it sometimes takes a fair amount of energy just to get it. I mean, look at squirrels and nuts. It takes them a lot of energy just to maintain their life through the winter. Yes, ma'am.
Shelter can also just mean putting on your rain jacket.
Like it. I like it. Your first line of shelter is exactly what you're wearing. Thank you. And if you can maintain that, that's, remember the hygiene piece, that includes all your clothing. Dirty clothing lets more heat through. It's like wet insulation in your house or dirty insulation in your house. There's not the air pockets in there anymore. It's dirty. It doesn't insulate as well. So you maintain your first layer, maintain your next layers, and away you go. Okay, our survival cocktail. A little bit of fitness, a little bit of technique, and a whole lot of what's between your ears. I decide that I can do this. Okay, that is all I have for today. There are, if you guys have time this morning, you're welcome to look through this. When's the next thing in here?
4 o'clock.
Okay, so I'll leave this up for a little while if you guys want to look at it. This is a simple shelter that I have down here. It's merely one of these bivy sacks, two garbage bags, and a space blanket. I lived in one of these with students for 2 or 3 years. I mean, not constantly, but teaching students a night a week, 2 or 3 times a month, and it was down to 10 degrees. Yeah, you won't, actually it was a little below 10 degrees. This is one of those shelters that you gotta add a little improvement to it. Under here, I put a tarp, but it's better. When I did it, we were down south of Sprague where it's all grassland. Mm-hmm. I just took 5 minutes before I went to bed, pulled up a bunch of grass, made myself a little bed, put that on top of it, and away I went. Now, that's not a comfy night's sleep. That is sleep for an hour, wake up shivering, shiver till you get warm, go back to sleep again. But we all woke up alive in the morning. So that's just one type of shelter. There's many, 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 many others that we'll talk about tomorrow or the next day. So, for those of you that are not coming back tomorrow, I apologize, but to give the best training, I limit it to 10 so I can give some individual attention to those 10 folks. For those 10 that are coming tomorrow, please stay for just a couple minutes afterwards. I got a couple things to talk to you about. For those of you guys that don't have anything to do right at the moment, please feel free to look through. And oh, I forgot, down on the far end is all just resources. The books and stuff that I have learned from, and some of them have sources on them. If you don't see a source on it, just ask. I'll let you know. But if I could see those 10 folks real quick. Oh, there was another thing, I'm sorry. If you guys are interested, I have a survival kit list. It's the things that I like in a kit. That how to help yourself book down there. He has another kit that he recommends. Everybody has their own isms. Please feel free. There's one of those for everybody if you guys want.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Absolutely, guys. Thank you.